From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Miss World pageant was supposed to be held this weekend in Nigeria, but it was driven out by Muslim protests. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nigerian women's rights activist Aisha Imam. She's risking her life to protest the recent application of a conservative Islamic criminal justice system through much of northern Nigeria. Also, actor Steve Buscemi on verbal riffing. He starred in Ghost World, Miller's Crossing, and Reservoir Dogs. He's starring in the new movie Love in the Time of Money. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers the band The Love and Spoonful. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new HBO docudrama Live from Baghdad, which premieres Saturday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration repeated today that it has evidence that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, despite Iraqi denials. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer declined to give any details about the evidence, but he said the administration will share it with UN weapons inspectors. Iraq has said it will provide the inspectors with a detailed declaration of its weapons technologies on Saturday, but Iraqi officials insisted that it will not show that their country has any nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz told ABC News yesterday that Iraq does have equipment that could be defined as dual use, meaning it could have military as well as civilian applications. Shares of United Airlines lost more than two-thirds of their value today after the federal government said the company wasn't eligible for loan guarantees. The decision brought the company one step closer to a bankruptcy filing. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
United Chief Executive Glenn Tilton spent the day meeting with the airline's pilots union, which owns a major stake in the company. Later, he said the airline was considering a number of financial options and bankruptcy was not inevitable. The Air Transportation Stabilization Board turned down United's request for $1.8 billion in loan guarantees, saying the airline had not presented a financially sound business plan. The airline can reapply, but it may not have time. United has to make nearly $1 billion in debt payments by next week. Many analysts say the company now has no real choice but to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Doing so would allow the airline to keep operating while it restructures its debts. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.
The snowstorm that hit the South and the East Coast shut down schools and slowed almost all air travel in the Washington, D.C. region. Lisa Nurnberger reports from member station WAMU.
The weather caused almost every flight in the Washington area to be delayed or canceled. Public schools across the region were closed, with a bit of confusion about D.C. schools, which denounced they would close after some employees and students, like this 14-year-old ninth grader, already arrived.
Well, it really stunk because after we got to school, they decided that it was canceled. And then a lot of people didn't have any way to get home because our parents had already gone to work and everything.
The school superintendent says he initially wanted to keep schools open because so many students get free or reduced-priced meals. Meanwhile, most local and federal government employees were allowed to take unscheduled leave. Power outages mainly occurred in central and southern Virginia, where ice mixed with snow. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Nurnberger in Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 114 points, or 1.3%, to close at 8,623 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 19 points, 1.3%, to close at 1410. This is NPR News. South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond celebrated his 100th birthday today with a party on Capitol Hill. The oldest and longest-serving senator entered Congress as a Democrat 48 years ago. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
At the party, incoming Majority Leader Trent Lott of Mississippi recalled Thurmond's first leap into national politics in 1948.
When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
A longtime segregationist, Thurmond strongly opposed the Civil Rights Act. When it was signed into law in 1964, he became a Republican. Still, he would later hire black staffers, and they were among those he thanked at his birthday party.
Appreciate what you've done for me, and may God allow you to live a long time and enjoy the time. Thank you very much.
All right.
David Wilma, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Federal Election Commission has fined the Mattel toy company nearly $500,000 for making illegal political contributions. The civil agreement comes in response to charges that Mattel reimbursed individual donors for their contributions to candidates, political party committees, and political action committees. The FEC said there was evidence that the scheme was run by a former senior vice president at Mattel, who apparently concealed the payments from his superiors at the company. Recipients of the donations included both Democrats and Republicans. The FEC said there was no evidence that any of the recipients knew the donations came from Mattel. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aisha Imam, is a women's rights activist in Nigeria. To understand what she's up against, consider the upheaval that forced out the Miss World pageant, which had been scheduled to be held in Nigeria this weekend. Muslims protested against the pageant, saying it was indecent and immoral. Rioting broke out after a fashion journalist wrote that the Prophet Muhammad probably would have chosen a wife from among the contestants. Protesters burned down her newspaper's office, and the deputy governor of Zamfara State, where the pageant was supposed to be held, issued a fatwa calling for the journalist's death. Zamfara was the first state in Nigeria to adopt a conservative Islamic criminal legal system, or Sharia, after the military government was replaced by a civilian one in 1999. Aisha Imam has campaigned against the adaptation of this law. She's the executive director of the group Baobab for Women's Human Rights. On Monday, she received the John Humphrey Freedom Award from the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development in Montreal. I asked her if she expected problems when the Miss World pageant was initially planned for Nigeria.
I knew there was likely to be trouble because it's both conservative Muslims and conservative Christians are uncomfortable with the idea of beauty pageants in particular. But the likelihood that it was actually going to escalate into the type of conflict and injuries and deaths that has happened, that I think most people didn't foresee.
I'd like your reaction to the sentence the journalist wrote in Nigeria that was responded to with the fatwa. And she wrote about the Miss World pageant, "What would Muhammad think? In all honesty, he probably would have chosen a wife from one of them, from one of the contestants." What was your reaction when you heard that line?
I think it was fairly foolish and somewhat irresponsible to have printed it in the climate of tenseness in Nigeria right now. It's not been unusual for there to be a good deal of conflict, including violence. Nonetheless, that does not excuse the burning down of this day office, nor the fights and conflicts, the burning of mosques or churches, and especially not the deaths and injuries. And it certainly doesn't excuse the fatwa. One thing I'd like to make clear, though, is that a fatwa is simply a legal opinion. Nobody is obliged to follow it. And anybody can have a fatwa. Depends on who you ask. Anybody can give you a fatwa depending on what their particular opinion is. I don't think that the deputy governor of Zamfara State is particularly religiously or morally qualified to be giving fatwas. But secondly, I think that for any state government to endorse something that is calling for people to kill somebody else without due process of law is simply an incitement to murder and is worse than irresponsible.
Now, the state that has endorsed the fatwa, Zamfara State, is one of 12 states within Nigeria that has taken on this more conservative form of Islamic law. It was actually the first state to adapt this form of law. What exactly has it adapted?
Well, actually, what has happened in Nigeria is that since independence, what we've had is that Muslim laws have been largely confined to personal laws. So marriage, divorce, inheritance, child custody and guardianship, except as encapsulated in the penal code, which was adopted around independence, Muslim laws was not reflected in criminal legislation. And in the penal code, it was it had an influence, but it was not directly what is now being passed as Sharia. What has happened is that in the Sharia acts that states have passed, beginning, as you said, with Zamfara, they've picked up on particularly conservative variations and taken those even without the safeguards that existed in 13th and 14th century legislation. So it's not that they've reverted to a strict form of Muslim laws. What they've actually done is taken up a truncated and twisted version of it. For instance, a lot of the punishments that they give, which they claim come from the Quran, stoning, for example, is nowhere mentioned in the Quran. So the claim that they are picking up laws that are divinely given is not at all true.
12 out of the 19 states of northern Nigeria, and most of this area is Muslim, now practice Sharia, the Islamic law. This shift to Islamic law happened in 1999 after the end of military rule with the start of a civilian government. Were you surprised by that? Did you think that at the end of military rule that things would loosen up a little bit as opposed to getting more conservative and more anti-woman?
The thing that's clear to those of us who work on women rights issues is that it's not easy to make an automatic assumption that civilian rule means more women's rights and military rule doesn't. But what I do want to comment on is the reason why the adoption of Sharia law has proved to be surprisingly popular at much of the grassroots level. And it's not for the reasons that I think that most people outside of Nigeria think. It's less about religious identity and more about aspirations for personal security, law and order, anti-corruption and social justice. One of the things that's very often said is that where there are strict punishments, and I understand that there are many states in the US who where this is believed also, but that where there are strict punishments, there will be an increase in law and order. And in Nigeria, many people have suffered from a breakdown in law and order, the inability to rely on the police to be able to carry out policing duties, the increase in armed robbery that used to be more or less confined to the relatively wealthy, but is now happening also in very poor neighborhoods. And so that was one hope, that out of Sharia or strict criminal legislation and harsh punishments would come law and order and an increase in personal security for ordinary people. But increasingly, the implementation of it is seeing that rather than focusing on security, on such issues as embezzlement at the top ends of theft, that it's issues of morality and only poor people who are being picked up and punished for it. And there is increasing, I think, dissatisfaction and disillusionment with it. And I think people are beginning to see past the facade to the fact that it was simply a political ploy.
Are the new Islamic laws that have been instituted in states through northern Nigeria particularly harsh for women?
In principle, they're not particularly harsh for women. In principle, they're actually absolutely gender neutral. There are exactly the same punishments for women as for men. But clearly, in the implementation, there has been a great deal of discrimination. For instance, more women are being charged with zina or immorality offences than are men. And obviously, it takes two to engage in any immoral act, if it is immoral. Secondly, when men are charged, they have often been offered a chance to retract confessions. And technically, if you retract a confession and there isn't the evidence of four witnesses, then you cannot be charged with it. So men are being offered the chance to retract confessions. Women are not. They're not even informed of the provision that it's possible. Thirdly, often for crimes like rape, men are being charged under the previous penal code as opposed to the new Sharia legislation, which has a lesser punishment. Whereas for consensual sex outside of marriage, women are being charged with offences for which the ultimate punishment is supposed to be stoning or whipping. And men, for rape, are being charged under an act which gives lesser offences. So that's very, very clear gender discrimination in the way it's being implemented.
Tell us about one of the cases that you took on, working on behalf of a woman who was going to be subjected to a very harsh punishment.
Well, there are a number. The first case was that of Bria Magazu, she was then 13 years old, who got pregnant and was sentenced to whipping. In the law as it stands, whipping is for people who are not married, women who are not married, and stoning is for people who are or who ever have been married. And so she was 13, she was convicted and sentenced to whipping. When we intervened, the judges in the case said that she would not be whipped until after she had finished breastfeeding, which is also a standard provision in Muslim laws, which gave us time to start filing an appeal. But what happened was two things. One, the governor, the executive arm of Zamfara State, started intervening in the judicial process, which is itself illegal, and the court officials were directed not to accept the appeal. I mean, physically, they were refusing the pieces of paper for the application of the appeal. But secondly, in the face of both national and international protests, the governor of Zamfara State was proudly boasting about resisting these Westerners and these infidels and apostates, which is what he calls those of us who are Muslim and who oppose what he's doing. And had the sentence brought forward without notice, she was informed the night before, and then had her whipped. So that one of the things that is very clear to us is that international protest does need to be very carefully managed if it's not to be counterproductive.
When you said that she was whipped, this was a particularly harsh whipping too. I think it was like 100 strokes of the cane. Do I have that right?
It is 100 strokes of the cane, but there are also regulations about having to hold a book, usually the Quran, between your forearm and the side of your chest, so that in fact only the lower part of your arm, the whipper's arm, can be moved. So each blow in itself is not very hard, but 100 blows is a lot. And not only that, it's the public humiliation.
It sounds like the law has not only become more restrictive and the penalties more severe, it sounds like there are men in Nigeria who now feel justified in attacking women on the streets when the men think that the women are displaying a loose morality.
That's true. And I think that there is a general feeling that men now have the right to stop women wherever they see them if they think they're not dressing properly or they're behaving in an immoral way. I think, to be accurate, one thing that we shouldn't forget is that actually a number of men have also been charged under these acts and have also been whipped, okay, although none of them have been sentenced to stoning.
Mm-hmm.
But what is clear is that except in some states, like again Kano, where the state government has discussed with members of the ulama, the Muslim clergy, and made public announcements on the radio, on the television, in the newspapers, that people taking the law into their own hands will not be allowed to do so. In Zamfara, for example, they have very clearly given not just tacit but formal approval to vigilante groups of young men going around and imposing their version of what life should be like on everybody else. So I think clearly there is a severe problem there.
My guest is Nigerian women's rights activist Aisha Imam. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Aisha Imam. She's just won a human rights award, the John Humphrey Freedom Award, for her human rights work on behalf of women. She's the founding director of Baobab for Women's Human Rights, which is a group in Nigeria where she lives. Now, you're a Muslim, yes?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how you were taught growing up to think about adultery or pregnancy out of wedlock and what the consequences might be? I mean, what the sense of morality was in your house? I'm assuming that there wasn't the sense of ultra-harsh penalties.
Well, it would be true to say of all of Nigeria, I think, that while it's never been approved, it has never been thought that any group had the right to make a direct punishment. Mm-hmm. You know, so there might be some social ostracism. But certainly, until 1999, it was not a legal offence.
Pregnancy out of wedlock wasn't a legal problem. Adultery wasn't a legal offence either?
No, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It might be, you know, a social solecism, but mm-hmm. it was not a criminal offence.
Right.
There was nothing that the courts would do about that. It was just, you know, it was just not thought of. Certainly during the years that I was growing up.
Did you grow up with a knowledge of women's rights, or is that something that you learned later on in life?
I always grew up with it. It was a knowledge, I think, generally of rights as a whole. I think many children are born with a sense of this is fair or this isn't fair. And the pity is of it is that somehow along the line their socialization trains that innate sense of fairness for everybody out of them. And I suppose I was lucky in that my parents and my upbringing encouraged that sense of justice. The fact that I work on women's human rights is because there is a particular need there. But I do see women's human rights as part of a panoply of human rights for everybody. And yes, always. I can remember since in secondary school, I was 12 or 13, we started a club for, I have to say it, good eating and good works.
What was that about?
Well, I was in boarding school and we were not enamored of the food. So the good eating was about, you know, having treats. But the good works were about doing things that would help other people.
So you got an early start there. because of the like ultra conservative strain within the Islamic world now, many people think that Islam must be incompatible with women's rights and with certain larger human rights, and with democracy. And I'm wondering, from your Islamic upbringing and your knowledge now of what's happening in certain Islamic states within Nigeria, do you think that Islam is incompatible with women's rights?
No. The issue is not what Islam is or isn't. It's the use that some Muslims make of Islam within Muslim discourses. And I make a distinction between Islam, the religion, and Muslim, what people who believe in the religion do or don't do while ascribing it to the religion. And it's very clear that there are some obviously very conservative ideas about women's rights that are held by some Muslim. But there are also some very, very progressive ideas about women's rights that are held by other Muslims. A family friend, an uncle of mine, in the 1950s wrote a series of articles on women's rights in Islam in which he argued that women had the right to vote, the right to go to school, the right to work outside of the house, the right not to be secluded. That was the 1950s in Nigeria. So what we're doing is not new. In fact, if you look at Muslim history, a lot of the incidences that are referred to even as sunnah, that is to say the traditions of the life of the Prophet, are women going to the Prophet and saying, so-and-so says I can't do this, is that so? And the Prophet saying, of course not, of course you can do it. For example, in one case, a young woman came to the Prophet and said, my father wants to marry me to my cousin. Does he have the right to do this? And the Prophet said, no, he doesn't. And so the young woman says, okay, I don't mind being married to him, but I just wanted to be clear that I had the choice. You know, that was the Prophet directly. Now, how that gets transmuted into saying that in Maliki Sharia law, fathers have the right of ijbar, which is the right to compel their young daughters in marriage, is not a total mystery, but it's clearly inconsistent with both what's actually in the Quran and with what the traditions of the Prophet are themselves.
We've been talking about Islam in Nigeria. Nigeria has a large Christian population. Is there the same kind of ultra-conservative strain or extremist strain now in Christianity in Nigeria as there is in Islam?
Yes, to some extent. The one thing that you might know is, or may not know, is that in fact Kaduna, which is where most of this fighting is going on, is about 50% Muslim and 50% Christian. So it's not a Muslim state. The issue is not just that they're conservatives. It's that they're what I call essentialist identity politics, or what other people have referred to as fundamentalists, who are not just saying we have these views, but who are saying that we are willing to impose these views by force on other people. So yes, there are both Muslims and Christians who do that. The problem is that in the Muslim communities, there are people who are manipulating that for political reasons who are in positions of state power.
You went to college in England.
And I'm, also in Nigeria.
And in Nigeria, okay. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how the years you spent in England affected your politics, your sense of religion, or your sense of women's rights?
When I was an undergraduate in England, I remember feeling that I was expected to be two separate people in my politics. I could join women's groups that were largely white and middle class, and I could join groups around black people's rights, which were largely working class but very male-dominated, or I could join groups for social justice, which were mostly white, male, and middle class, but there was nowhere that I could be all facets of me together, if you like. And so what I found when I came to Nigeria was that when I went back to Nigeria after I finished my first degree, that was a place where, in fact, that I could insist on being interested in social justice issues, interested in poverty issues, and interested in women's rights issues. And that was the point at which we formed this group that's called Women in Nigeria, which still exists. This was the early 80s, which argued that women's rights issues and social justice issues in general had to be tackled simultaneously, rather than what we were hearing usually, which is, let's deal with the general problems first and then we'll get to the women.
Right. Have there been attacks against you or your group because of your work on behalf of women's human rights?
So far, none of us, thankfully, have been physically attacked, but we have been threatened, and me in particular. I take all the precautions that I can. But at the same time, if we don't speak up, if we don't do the best, then we've already lost the battle.
Aisha Imam is the executive director of the Nigerian group Baobab for Women's Human Rights. On Monday, she received the John Humphrey Freedom Award from the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development in Montreal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by this and other NPR member stations. By Audi, the luxury car company with quattro all-wheel drive in every model line. Details at audiusa.com. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Steve Buscemi. He's starring in the new movie Love in the Time of Money. Ed Ward remembers the band The Lovin' Spoonful, and David Bianculli previews the HBO docudrama Live from Baghdad, which premieres Saturday. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Saturday, HBO presents a docudrama called Live from Baghdad, a behind-the-scenes story about how CNN managed to scoop its rivals in covering the first night of the Persian Gulf War 12 years ago. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
There's no question that Live from Baghdad, this weekend's new telemovie from HBO, is timely. Not with another President Bush squaring off at this very moment against Saddam Hussein. There's also no question that in the media world of corporate synergy, this docudrama is self-serving. HBO is making a movie about CNN, one that presents it as the little news operation that could, clearly and cleverly outmaneuvering the bigger stars and deeper budgets of its broadcast news rivals. Both HBO and CNN are owned by the same company now, AOL Time Warner, so there's reason to be suspicious of the motives in producing it. But what really counts is the final product. After all, CBS recently made a TV movie about Jackie Gleason, one of the biggest stars in its history, and that movie was terrible. Live from Baghdad is excellent. It tells a fascinating story, and it does it by coming at the subject from a surprising but absolutely proper direction. The focus of Live from Baghdad is on how Cable News Network and its reporting team based in Baghdad managed to keep broadcasting on January 16, 1990, when all around them was exploding with bombs and all other networks had lost communications and gone silent. That first night before the pictures arrived, it was CNN as radio and was the most historic and riveting live eyewitness account of a war strike since Edward R. Murrow intoned, "This is London." Peter Arnett, John Holloman, and Bernard Shaw, providing all-night play-by-play from the Al Rashid Hotel, reported freely and bravely. They put CNN on the map that night and relayed a type of uncensored frontline war reporting that hasn't been equaled or approached since. By the way, don't expect it to happen again next time. The competition is stiffer now, and the military machineries on both sides have gotten savvier about how to restrict news coverage. But Live from Baghdad tells about how CNN got in position to get away with it that fateful night. It's a story that begins long before Peter Arnett arrived on the scene, so the tale is told from the point of view of CNN producer Robert Wiener. The telemovie is based on his memoirs, and Wiener is one of four authors of the teleplay. Moonstruck playwright John Patrick Shanley is another. But it's not especially self-serving. What it is convincing. Live from Baghdad is full of the telling little details, the small and often unflattering things that illuminate character and pull you into that world. Michael Keaton plays Wiener, and his performance in the movie is stripped away of any grand moments of overacting. Like David Suchet, who plays the Iraqi Minister of Information who turns out to be Wiener's most valuable contact, Keaton plays his part close to the vest. Helena Bonham Carter and Lily Palmer play two of Wiener's colleagues, but there's no wartime romance forced into the story. And when Peter Arnett arrives late in the narrative, played perfectly by a gregarious Bruce McGill, the behind-the-scenes battles for news access already have been fought and won. Live from Baghdad is a lot like a Persian Gulf All the President's Men. It's the legwork that matters. And retraced intelligently, it's the legwork that's fascinating. It takes a long time and a lot of patience for Wiener to finally work his way into the office of the Iraqi Minister of Information. When he does, he instantly asks for the moon, beginning with several pieces of equipment to make CNN's job easier. Here's Keaton and Suchet playing out the scene where they first discuss the dedicated phone line that turns out to be CNN's secret weapon in staying on the air.
How can I help you?
Well, a few things, actually. There's a request there for a couple of pieces of equipment. I need a four-wire and a flyaway.
What is this?
Well, the four-wire is kind of an elaborate phone system that will allow me to get through to my bureau in Amman. The flyaway is a little more elaborate.
Now, this has already been requested by your Atlanta office. What else?
I want an interview with President Saddam Hussein.
You've made me a written request?
It's in there as well, yeah.
I'll see what I can do.
How soon?
You take liberties.
I'm an American. We're the liberty people.
When the war starts, that phone line becomes CNN's lifeline to the world. And when the war arrives in Live from Baghdad, it arrives with a fury that is amazingly well dramatized. That first night watching CNN in real life, all we had was the audio. This telemovie recreates what we didn't see, both inside and outside the hotel room, where the CNN reporters and crew worked and talked through the night. It was remarkable television then. And in this HBO TV movie, it's pretty remarkable television now.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. My guest Steve Buscemi has starred in such films as Ghost World, The Real Blonde, Miller's Crossing, Reservoir Dogs, Armageddon, and Escape from L.A. He directed Animal Factory and Tree's Lounge and has directed episodes of The Sopranos and Oz. He's one of the stars of The Gray Zone, which is still playing in some cities. In the new film Love in the Time of Money, which is opening slowly around the country, he plays an artist. An influential figure in the art world, played by Malcolm Getz, thinks Buscemi is flirting with him. When Getz responds with a kiss, Buscemi rebuffs him.
All right. You need a drink?
Yeah. Well, so, was it just me then? I mean, did I just, you know, make this whole thing up in my mind?
Make what up?
Between us, this thing,
I'm
this...
sorry if you misinterpreted something, but, you know, I didn't mean to...
No, you did. You definitely flirted with me. I'm not that out of my mind.
I don't think so.
Oh, come on, please, just tell the truth, okay?
I thought you were married.
I am, happily.
But you're gay.
I want to kiss you. That doesn't make me gay.
Well, I'd say maybe that points in the general direction.
Oh, God. Ugh.
In the new Biographical Dictionary of Film, David Thompson writes, Steve Buscemi is one of the best-known faces in modern movies. He is easily cast as hood, lowlife, baby-faced thug, or as a kind of Brooklynite Peter Lorre. He is our best sickly psychopath. I wanted to know if when Buscemi started acting, he was confident he could use his face for good effect, or if there were things he wanted to change when he looked in the mirror.
I don't remember thinking that I, you know, wanted to change my looks. I mean, I was really skinny. I mean, I was sort of self-conscious about that. It wasn't until years later, when I was in my, I guess I was about 20 or 21, and I was taking a course, this class in making commercials. And for the first time, I saw myself on videotape and, you know, saw myself on a TV. And I was amazed at how crooked my teeth looked, because for some reason, in the mirror, they didn't seem weird at all. But when I first saw it on a TV, I thought, oh my God, is that what I look like? I've had dentists over the years, you know, really wanting to have a go at my mouth, but you know, I mean, why change now?
Oh, good. Good. Some critics have compared you to Peter Lorre.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if you ever particularly liked Peter Lorre.
I love Peter Lorre.
Yeah, me too.
I remember seeing him, you know, I mean, in lots of films, but one of the films that I love him in is Arsenic and Old Lace. I used to watch that as a kid a lot. I think he's a wonderful actor. And, yeah, I mean, it's flattering that I should be compared to him.
Well, I completely agree. I'm always interested in actors' voices, and I think, boy, you have a great voice.
Thanks.
And in some of your films, you almost do these like speed raps, you know, because in some of the films you're just this like great riffer, verbal riffer. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have a favorite of those scenes.
Of a talkie scene?
Yeah, of one of your like verbal riffs.
Well, the one that was the most challenging was in Miller's Crossing, the character I played in that, this character, Mink, who just, when I read the script, it was like, you know, three or four pages of straight dialogue coming from this one character. And so that's something that I, you know, felt like this guy must be a fast talker, and it's something that I worked on. And it's something, you know, from doing plays with John Jezerin, whose work is always performed at a, you know, pretty fast clip, that you know, it came pretty naturally to me, and it was really fun to do.
Why don't we hear that scene?
Okay.
Not a thing, Tom. Look, if it ain't my business, I got not a thing to say. Listen, Bernie wants to see what's important.
Yeah, well, I'm right here. I'm not made of glass.
Yeah, but he's nervous walking around in public, Tom. He's the right guy, but he's very nervous. I mean, who wouldn't be?
Look,
I mean, the spot he's in, who wouldn't be? He asked me to ask you to ask Leo to take care of him, you know, put in a good word with Leo. Leo listens to you. Not that Leo wouldn't help the Shimada anyway. A guy like Bernie, a squared, you like the Shimada, a straight shooter like him.
I don't get it, Mike.
Well, what's to get? It's as plain as a nose on your face.
I thought you were Eddie Dane's sycophant.
Yeah, Tom, that's right, but a guy could have more than one friend, can he? I mean, not that I want the Dane to know about it, but a square G like the Shimada, he's the right guy, Tom. He's a square shooter. I know he's got a mixed reputation, but for a Sheenie, he's got a lot of good qualities.
What's going on between you and Bernie?
Nothing, Tom. We're just friends, you know, amigos.
You're a fickle boy, Mink. If Eddie Dane finds out that you got another amigo, well, I don't peg him for the understanding type.
Find out? How's he gonna find out? Damn it, Tom. You and me ain't even been talking. Jesus, Tom, damn it. Jesus.
That's Steve Buscemi in Miller's Crossing. One of the movies that I think a lot of people really discovered you in was Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino's first film.
Right.
And this is a heist film in which each of the guys in the heist are named for a color. You're Mr. Pink. How did you get to be Mr. Pink?
I mean, I read the script like a lot of other actors and then talked with Quentin on the phone and... He, you know, I mean, at that time, I had done a few films before, and, you know, some of them were pretty obscure. Quentin knew all of them. So I was pretty impressed that he even knew who I was. I auditioned for the role. I think I auditioned twice. I can't remember. And... later on, Quentin told me that it wasn't my audition that actually convinced them. He saw a casting tape of me from a film that I auditioned for. It was a Neil Simon film. And it was on the basis of that audition tape that he decided to hire me because he said that for some reason the shirt I was wearing... And the way my hair was, I had it, I guess, slicked back. He thought that I looked like a criminal. But this is how I showed up, you know, for a Neil Simon, which I didn't get the role. But I'm glad that I went.
I think that's a scream, that a failed audition for a Neil Simon movie would lead to your part in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Let me play a scene from the opening of Reservoir Dogs when all of the guys involved in the heist are sitting around in a diner. And you're talking about how you don't tip, no matter how good the service is.
Right.
You don't believe in tipping.
And by the way, that tipping speech, I think, was, you know, it's pretty much Quentin's real philosophy. I don't know if he still feels that way, but I took the rap for it. I mean, you know, for years when I would be in a diner or a restaurant, the waiters would steer clear of me.
Come on, throw in a buck.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in tipping?
You know what these chicks make? They make shit. Don't give me that. She don't make enough money, she can quit.
Let me just get this straight. You don't ever tip, huh?
I don't tip because society says I have to. All right, I mean, I'll tip if somebody really deserves a tip. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. But, I mean, it's tipping automatically. It's for the birds. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're just doing their job.
Hey, this girl was nice.
Hey, look, I ordered coffee, right? Now, we've been here a long time. She's only filled my cup three times. I mean, when I order coffee, I want it filled six times.
Six times? Well, you know, where she's too busy.
Words too busy shouldn't be in a waitress's vocabulary.
A slightly edited version of a scene from Reservoir Dogs. We'll be back with Steve Buscemi after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Steve Buscemi. He's starring in the new movie, Love in the Time of Money. You grew up in Valley Stream, Long Island. Your father was a sanitation worker. Did he collect trash?
He It sounds like that was his hobby of collecting cars.
Right.
But he worked behind the truck for years, and then he eventually became a foreman.
Knowing what your father did, professionally, how did it make you feel about work when you were growing up? What did you think work was? And I ask that because I think it's a really hard job to work behind a sanitation truck all day. I mean, you're doing really important work, and it's heavy lifting all the time, and it's being surrounded by, pretty terrible odors.
Well, I mean, I never got to see him at work. For him, having a civil service job was important because it provided, a steady paycheck and also security. When you retire, you have a pension. So that was something that he sort of instilled in myself and my brothers. And when we were 18, whatever test came up, be it the sanitation or the police or the fire department, we were required to take that test. For me, it was the fire department.
We actually worked in the fire department.
Yeah.
For how long?
For 4 years, 1980 to 84.
So that was your father's influence?
Absolutely, yeah.
And had you acted already before then, either in school or?
A little bit in high school, but I had already started taking classes at the Lee Strasberg Institute and studied a lot with John Strasberg and Sabra Jones. And then when I when they finally got to my name, because I had taken the test when I was 18 and was put on a list, and it took about 4 years for them to get to my name on the list. By that time, I was working as a furniture mover. I was trying to do stand-up comedy and wasn't really enjoying either of them. So when my name came up for the fire department, I stopped doing all of that and took the job and didn't do any acting for about a year. And then slowly I just started taking classes again and then meeting people like Mark Boone Jr. and Rockets Red Glare and started doing these performances downtown in the East Village and started doing a lot of theater while I was on the job. And it was kind of great because I, had a well-paying job for a single guy. And even though it was a full-time job, it afforded me a lot of time to pursue the acting as well.
And do you plan on making another movie yourself, like Animal Factory or Trees Lounge?
Yeah, we have the rights to a William Burroughs book, Queer, one of his early books. And Oren Moverman has written a screenplay based on the book, and it's something that we're actively trying to get financed.
Are you a big fan of Burroughs?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated by him, and this book, it concentrates on his time that he spent in Mexico City before he really did any writing, and just about his life there when he was married and he had kids, and but he was obsessed with this young student, and it caused great havoc in his life, and ended tragically for his wife.
Would you play Burroughs?
I would play a character named Will Lee, which is the character that's based on Burroughs.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that. I look forward to seeing it when you get it made.
Thank you very much.
Steve Buscemi is currently in two films, The Gray Zone and Love in the Time of Money. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward remembers The Love and Spoonful. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. One of those questions people love to debate is whether there was ever an American Beatles. A rock historian, Ed Ward, thinks the Love and Spoonful came close, even though they lacked the brilliant chemistry of Lennon and McCartney. The Spoonful drew on American folk music and some amazing songwriting talent. Here's Ed's retrospective of the band.
My whole life through, and now that I'm your guy, I'm gonna live and die for only you, baby, baby. Now you're gonna know all the ways I plan to thrill you so.
In the days before psychedelia and long guitar solos came around, and pop music wasn't a dirty word, the Love and Spoonful was probably the greatest band in America. Drawing on folk roots, writing classic songs, they could have gone far. John Sebastian was the son of a harmonica virtuoso of the same name, and he was a player in the New York folk scene, first coming to attention as a member of the Even Dozen Jug Band, a temporary assemblage that made a record for Elektra in 1964. In those days, there were folkies who hated the Beatles, and those who thought they were a good idea, and Sebastian was firmly in the second camp, as was his friend Mama Cass Elliott. It was in her apartment one night that he met a guy she'd been dying to introduce him to, Zalman Yanofsky, a Canadian folk singer and guitarist. The two hit it off, and before long, they'd poached half of a Long Island bar band and added bassist Steve Boone and drummer Joe Butler. Sebastian had also attracted a very gung-ho producer, Eric Jacobson, who was well-connected in the record business. Before long, the band, who had named themselves the Lovin' Spoonful after a line from a Mississippi John Hurt song, was playing regularly at a coffee house in Greenwich Village to some leftover beatniks. One night, Sebastian looked down from the stage and saw a young teenage girl dancing alone to the music and knew something had happened. That night, he went home and wrote a song. Weirdly, it took them 6 months of shopping the tape around before they found anyone who thought it was any good. Charles Koppelman and Don Rubin had just started something called Kama Sutra Records and had a deal with MGM, but no artists. They had the Spoonful finish an album's worth of material, had their manager send them off on the road, and by the summer of 1965, Do You Believe in Magic was in the top 10. Suddenly, girls were screaming at them, and the shows they were playing got bigger. Magic would be the first of seven straight top 10 singles, the third of which came off their next album, which was named for it.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream. Dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn.
Daydream was a great album, far less dependent on traditional material than the previous one. It was filled with great John Sebastian tunes, often written with Steve Boone. But there was tension building between Yanofsky and Sebastian, which came from a number of sources. Zal didn't think he was being well used in the context of the band, particularly in the studio. And then there was the matter of John stealing and then marrying his girlfriend. On the other hand, between incessant touring and yet another album gestating in the studio, plus two film soundtracks to work on, there wasn't a whole lot of time to fight. And the hits kept on coming, too, including the anthem for the summer of 1966.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity, doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match, yeah. But at night, it's a different world, go out and find a girl. Come on, and dance all night, despite the heat, it'll be all right. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer.
It seemed like nothing could stop them, but of course something could, the San Francisco Police Department. Late in the year, Zal and Steve Boone were busted for pot, and Zal, still a Canadian citizen, was told that if he didn't name his source, he'd be deported. Figuring he could use the spoonful's resources to get the guy a good lawyer, Zal gave him to the cops. But unfortunately, the guy's lawyer wasn't so good. And also, the last place you'd want a story like this to get out was in the Haight-Ashbury in 1966. The Love and Spoonful were narcs. By all accounts, Zanofsky became harder and harder to deal with after this, and the band split into pro and anti-Zal camps. Their next big hit was virtually a John Sebastian solo record.
Come and talk of all the things we did today. Here and laugh about our funny little ways while we have a few minutes to breathe. And I know that it's time you must leave. But darling, be home soon. I couldn't bear to wait an extra minute if you dawdle.
By June 1967, Zal was a solo act, replaced by another rocking folky, Jerry Yester. Yester played keyboards, not guitar, but he was an ace arranger. But by the end of the year, it was obvious. The Love and Spoonful weren't going anywhere, and it was time to call it a day. Zal eventually returned to Canada and opened an acclaimed restaurant. John made his famous appearance at Woodstock and later made zillions from his song Welcome Back, which was used as the theme of Welcome Back Cotter on TV. The other two guys hook up with Jerry Yester from time to time and tours The Spoonful. Not a sad ending at all, but not magic.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Daydream, which was released by The Love and Spoonful in 1966, was reissued this year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
K-19, the film about the nuclear-powered Soviet submarine that nearly had a nuclear meltdown during the Cold War, is out on video next week. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from retired U.S. Navy captain and anti-sub warfare expert Peter Hoogthausen, who wrote the book that the film is based on. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.